True Crime Cast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to True Crime Cast with my friend John. I'm Jamie. We're thrilled to have you here listening to us. Thank you for all the downloads from our first episode last week. If you missed it, I recommend going back and listening to Genesis, which is our first episode. We also want to ask that if you would, please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review. That really helps us to rise up the iTunes rankings and get seen in searches more often. So if you would, we would greatly appreciate that. John, what are we talking about tonight?
All right, Jamie. So as we mentioned last week, one of our favorite podcasts of all time is the great series called Up and Vanished. So Up and Vanished covered a case out of Ocilla, Georgia, and her name was Tara Grinstead. Now, this case originally took place back in 2005. So let's just dig right in and talk about what happened here. So in October of 2005, at the time, Tara Grinstead was 30 years old. So Tara was a former beauty queen in the state of Georgia. She was a school teacher. It's been reported that several students looked up to this lady. So from all accounts that we have, this lady was just an outstanding lady in her community. A lot of students looked up to her. You know, she wasn't getting into a lot of trouble. So just a beautiful lady and, you know, well-liked in her community. So October 22nd, 2005, Tara goes to a beauty pageant in her community. She's not participating, from what I understand. She's there just kind of hanging out.
I believe she was there kind of as a coach to some of the younger ladies participating, to give encouragement and suggestions and to, again, you mentioned community, she's giving back, so she was there to help out.
Right. So nothing remarkable happens there, but she leaves that event and goes to a barbecue party that is hosted by, I believe, her principal or superintendent, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's her superintendent. So from what we understand about the night, just a typical Georgia party, right? It's on a Saturday night. They're probably watching the Georgia Bulldogs beat the crap out of somebody, having a good time. From what we understand from later accounts, I think she had a pretty detailed conversation with her superintendent. We may get into that some tonight, but she leaves this party around 11 o'clock at night, really never to be seen again. So that was over 10 years ago. And so what happens is Sunday, nobody hears from her. On Monday, she is to report to school, and she doesn't show up. And not only doesn't she show up, but she doesn't call anybody to let them know she's not coming in. From based on all reports we have, that is not like her. She would have called in had she been sick or not able to come into work that day. So around 9 a.m., they still haven't heard from her. They go ahead and call the police to have them do a welfare check at her house. So the police arrive at her house. They knock on the door. They notice the door is locked. So there's no signs of entry into the house that we know of. But Tara doesn't come to the door. So what happens is they force their way into this house, and nothing's there. Jamie will talk a little bit more about some of the clues or some of the things left behind in the house. But from everything I understand, the house is pretty well kept. There's no obvious signs of any struggles, no obvious signs of any intrusions. So they don't find anything remarkable other than her phone and her purse are missing, and Tara is not there. But yeah, no forcible signs of entry into the house, and kind of baffled as to where this lady could be.
Her dog was in the backyard. It was a house dog, so it normally stayed in the house. So it was if someone had come there and put the dog out. Obviously, if the dog was inside, it may have raised a fuss for an intruder that neighbors could hear or something like that. But the dog was in the backyard, and she wasn't home, which also was not normally the case. The dog would be inside when she wasn't home. Do you want to continue on the evidence, what they did and did not find?
Yeah, let's go into that now.
Yeah. So one thing they did find, and actually police did not discover this initially, but Dr. Maurice Godwin was a private investigator hired by Tara's family. And he plays a big role in this case, both early on and even continually in his work with Payne Lindsay from Up and Vanished. One thing he found was a necklace on the floor of her bedroom. It was actually underneath her bed, kind of between the cracks, and it looked as if it had been pulled off of her neck. The clasp was broken, but it was not thrown. There were not beads all over the room. It was almost like somebody had just pulled it off her neck and dropped it or placed it where it was. And again, you mentioned that nothing was out of place otherwise. The bed was made. There were no broken lamps, nothing like that. But the necklace was left in the floor.
I remember Dr. Godwin talking about that, and he said that, if I'm not mistaken, and you tell me if I'm wrong, I think he had to get on his hands and knees, look under the bed, and he found it underneath the bed. And there was some stuff underneath the bed that he didn't think detectives had looked at when he was making this discovery. So he alluded to the fact that he thought the detectives did not do as thorough of a job as he would have liked to have seen in this case, as evidenced by him finding something left behind by the detectives.
And something he could see with his naked eyes. I mean, it wasn't something that he brought in special technology for, or he brought in a team of dogs for. Like, it was something that he looked under the bed and saw that they completely ignored. There are some things they found, though.
Yeah, so they found a pretty key piece of evidence outside of the house, which just completely baffles me. So what they found was a latex glove outside of the front door of Tara's house. Now, there is a major conspiracy theory about this glove, and I don't know if we want to get into that now or later on into the podcast, but basically they found this glove outside. They tested it, and they found a match. It was a DNA, full count DNA of a white male. Unfortunately, they ran it through their system and there were no matches in the system, but they do have it in case somebody ever comes up. They can match their DNA against this glove and have a potential suspect. Do you want to get into the conspiracy about the glove now or wait? I don't know.
I do. I question the DNA because I question a lot about the glove. As Maurice Godwin and then Payne Lindsay tried to look back into this glove, there were a lot of inconsistencies. For example, when someone went in to ask about further testing, they were told that the glove was left in a brown paper bag on the desk of one of the detectives. So the fact that the DNA or the evidence on the glove may not have been protected is a question. The chain of custody is usually written on a sealed bag of a piece of evidence. In case you don't know what that is, essentially it's person who collects the evidence, puts it in a sealed bag, writes their name, and that they put it in there. If it's opened at any point for testing, then the person doing the testing would write their name, write when they opened it and why they opened it, put it back in, write when they put it back in. So it's a very detailed log of who has touched or used the evidence for any reason. And there's so many questions about the chain of custody for this glove. And that's not even the biggest question about it.
So there's two other questions that come to my mind. This is a major deal. When you talk about leaving a key piece of evidence, and it's really the only major key piece of evidence that they have at this point, when you talk about leaving it out on a desk in the open for anybody to tamper with it, that's a major concern for me. But as Jamie's going to talk about here in a few minutes, we have some possible suspects who would have access to this glove every single day in their professions, and it's just laying out right in the middle of, you know, God, and everybody can get into it. So I just have a major concern about that. Another key piece that I heard about this glove is that it was always thought to be a white glove. So when it was found in the front yard, it was white. But now people are saying that the glove that they have in evidence is a blue glove.
Yes, there are people on the scene, whether it was a neighbor or a concerned friend that saw the police at the house, that stopped by and they saw a white glove in the yard, a white latex glove. And of course, I mean, you've been to a hospital. Some have white gloves, some have blue gloves, whatever you choose to take out of the package when the doctor's not looking and blow it up and pretend it's a balloon or whatever. But they come in different colors. And multiple people say they saw the white glove in the yard, but the one in evidence is blue. So how are we to trust anything to do with this glove when we don't know who had it, who touched it, who ended up with it? Everybody had access to it, and we don't even know what color it was supposed to be.
Right, and I think people will understand why that glove is so significant and why it just being left out in the middle of the room is going to be a major problem when we start talking about potential suspects. But for now, let's keep going with other evidence they found. Yeah. Go ahead.
You mentioned that the house was clean and everything was well kept, but her key and purse were missing. Well, what about her car was also still at the house?
Right. So her car was parked in its normal place in the driveway. The car was unlocked, and I don't know if she normally kept her car locked. It was a small town, so it's not outside of the realm of possibilities that this lady wouldn't have, you know, locked her car every night. But something was fishy about this car. So first off, the car, detectives noticed that her seat was pushed all the way back, kind of giving you the indication that a larger person was driving this car, or at least parked it in the driveway.
Tara Grunstead was 5'3".
Right. So my wife is around the same height. If she drives my Jeep, I get in my car, I have to push the seat all the way back. Like, my knees are up in the steering wheel if my wife drives my car. So there's no way that Tara put this car in the driveway if the seat was pushed all the way back. Now, maybe she got out of the car, realized she had lost something, maybe pushed the seat back all the way. I mean, you could make a case that, you know, she may have done something like this, but I mean, given the circumstances, given her disappearance, I don't think it's a coincidence that her seat's pushed all the way back. Something else in the car, which kind of speaks to the motive of this case, they found an envelope full of money. They found, I think it was at least $100 they found in this envelope. So when you start piecing all these things together and you start trying to figure out the motive and why this happened, kind of rules burglary out. There's nothing missing in her house. And there's money readily available in her car that somebody could have easily taken. They didn't do it.
Especially assuming they probably have the keys since we can't find them anywhere.
Right.
So other than that, there wasn't a lot of evidence found at the house, either by local police or by Dr. Maurice Godwin. So then you have to start looking at the evidence of the people around her. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the early suspects and some of their motives. And obviously the first person that's ever, I guess the first group of people looked at in any missing person or murder are the last person to see somebody alive, the first person to respond to the scene, and then any significant other that person may have. So it might be a spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend. And this case is no different. Tara Grunstead had a recent ex-boyfriend named Marcus Harper. He was an Army Ranger, and he had just come back from overseas, and he hadn't told her. They were recently broken up, and they were still going through a hard time. He had a reputation for being intense, sometimes violent, so of course they're going to look at him. One piece of evidence that came up is an email that actually Tara sent to Marcus's mom. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's pretty long. The first two-thirds of it is basically, why is Marcus ignoring me? This really hurts. I'm just going to read this one paragraph. After talking about how hurt she is, she says, "I am so depressed right now, but Marcus is the lucky one. He has his shell to protect him like the crab. He is strong and tough while I become weaker. This does not mean I'm a bad person. It means that I have put in first in my life, and I was happy having it that way. Now all that has been taken away. Just remind Marcus what I said about something happening to me or even him. He leaves it at this, and something may happen to me."
So what do you get out of that? Like, where does your head go when you read that?
My initial reaction was that she may hurt herself or kill herself if he continues to ignore her. But given the fact that she's missing, when you add that line into it, it sounds like she may be in some other kind of danger. What about you?
Yeah, so when I first heard that letter being read, I kind of thought the same thing, that she was, you know, she's obviously depressed. Obviously, this man means a lot to her. So I thought that she was, you know, suicidal in nature, that she may hurt herself if this relationship isn't restored and goes back to what it used to be. Something that threw me off, though, is that something may happen to him.
Yeah.
I don't know if that should be taken as a threat. I don't know what I think about that, honestly. It baffles. I don't know where Ed was when she wrote that.
I think what it says, and if you read the entire email, which is available at upandvanish.com, you can see that a lot of it doesn't make sense. It's obvious that she's very emotional. I mean, she's a school teacher. This should flow a lot better than it does, and the sentences work better than they do. But she wrote this from her heart and her ebbing and flowing emotion, so it's hard to keep up with.
Sure.
Anything else on Marcus? He was, man, his life was has been hard ever since this, just because he has been the prime suspect to most people. So if you think about it, in a small town, if you are accused of murder, whether you're charged with it or not, people are going to be looking at you differently and treating you differently.
Right. Something that I always thought was interesting about this suspect was that he had just got back from a deployment overseas and didn't tell Tara he was coming back in town. Now, this is before the breakup, I believe. So why wouldn't you tell your girlfriend that you're coming back in town and maybe want to visit, especially when you've been overseas for so long? Doesn't quite add up. So, you know, early on in my listening, I thought, man, this guy is a huge potential suspect. But we'll get into other stuff here in a minute that lets you know more about him.
Second suspect is a former student of hers named Anthony Vickers. He was 20 years old, and he had actually been arrested 6 months prior to her disappearance for criminal trespassing in her house. So potentially some stalking. Again, she was a beauty queen that taught high school students. I could understand some that there was probably some fascination there from the students, and it seems like he may have taken it a little too far after graduation of trying just to follow her and to go to her house when he wasn't welcome there.
They actually dated for, I don't know how long, but I know it was a consensual relationship. He did an interview that you can listen to on Up and Vanished where Tara asked him to keep this relationship on the down low because he was just recently graduated. She was much older than him. But they dated, and, you know, they were a couple. As controversial as it is, it's the truth, and that's what it is. So, yeah.
That was also a previous relationship. So he was looked at, especially considering the arrest. I mean, if somebody is arrested for trespassing, you have to look at them as somebody that's going to trespass again. And if somebody's on a property and they're not wanted there, you never know what's going to happen.
I'm sorry, Jamie. He did an interview with I don't know if it was with Payne Lindsay or somebody else, but we got our hands on it. And so he kind of downplays the situation at the house in a little, you know, in a manner that he says he was only there for a minute. Things got a little heated. He was yelling. It was reported that Tara did not call the police in that situation, but rather a neighbor overheard this argument and called. Apparently, Tara's house was just a few blocks away from his house, as well as also just a few blocks away from the police station. So he was getting in his car, pulling out of her house when the police arrived. He was arrested on the scene. So, I don't know, he kind of makes it to seem that it wasn't as big a deal as it was made out to be. But still, 6 months before this lady's disappearance, you're being arrested at her house for trespassing and almost like a domestic violence type situation. So it's a major deal, and that's what puts him as a potential suspect.
You had mentioned that early on, Marcus Harper, her military ex-boyfriend, was one of the suspects you felt most strongly about. It's probably an accurate way to put that. Mine was Heath Dykes.
Mm-hmm.
Heath was a guy that she seemed to be having an affair with. He's a married man. He was actually a police detective in Perry County. And he lived a little over an hour away, but his car was often spotted at her house. He had been missing for a while, and he actually drove to her house the night of her disappearance and left a card, like a business card, in her door. And her mom had called her and asked him to go check because she knew that they were having a relationship. And assuming that was after she had disappeared, if he's on the scene the night that the crime happens, he's a detective. I would think he would know how to clean up a crime scene and leave no evidence, especially him saying he didn't see anything. He said he didn't see a glove laying
right
in the grass. So to me, he was really suspect. He was having an affair with this woman. He was a detective that knew what he was doing, that knew what the cops would look at. I don't know. That rang a lot of bells for me.
Right, so let's put ourselves in his shoes for just a minute. He is called by her mother to drive over an hour away to check on her, right? And this is in the middle of the night. So if I'm this guy, I drove an hour to her house. I'm making some kind of contact with her before I head back to where I came from. So whether that's, I don't know if they're having an argument at this time, if things aren't as copacetic as they should be, but at least see her face, make sure she's okay. So if I get to that house and I'm knocking on her door and I don't get an answer, I'm a little concerned. I don't know if I'm her boyfriend or whatever that is. I may try to go in and make sure she's all right. This doesn't happen, or at least it appears it doesn't happen, which leads me to believe, yeah, this guy's a suspect. He's a detective. He didn't see a glove. He didn't notice anything fishy. He's capable of knowing what detectives are going to be looking at a crime scene. So, of course, I think it's within the realm of possibilities. This guy could totally do whatever he had done to Tara and cleaned it up to make it look like nothing had ever happened.
So, I mean, really, as far as suspects go and names that we have, for the first 11 years, all we really know is these three names: Marcus Harper, ex-boyfriend, Anthony Vickers, former student that also had a relationship with her, and Heath Dykes. So all men that she had been in relationships with. And those were the names that we had, but they weren't the only leads. What were some other leads that we had seen in more recent years?
So during the Up and Vanish podcast, we get a lead from just a crazy random source. So Payne Lindsay gets a phone call one day that somebody's underneath their house, a repairman, I think it's an AC repairman or something, is climbing under this house in the crawl space to do some duct work or run some lines or something along those lines. And he notices a patch of dirt underneath this house that has been obviously disturbed, and it's in the shape of an oval. I think underneath the house he also finds a shovel. So I have a crawl space, Jamie. There is absolutely no reason that I can think of to dig a hole underneath my crawl space and put something underneath the ground. So this gets back to Payne Lindsay. Payne Lindsay drives from Atlanta to Ocilla, or Ocilla, however you say this town's name, and actually gets under this guy's house with him and starts digging up earth to try to get samples or find evidence because they believe it could be the remains of Tara Grinstead.
Yeah, so again, there have been, I don't know, this is a cold case, right? So the first couple years, of course, they're investigating. They come up with the names that we had mentioned. They're getting no leads. They seem to be getting nowhere. So the case kind of goes cold, and they don't look at it. But then Payne Lindsay gets back involved. And for me, this was kind of a turning point, not only in the podcast, but in the case of people are actively looking for Tara. So for him to go and to look under this house and climb in there, that's a big step past sitting in front of a microphone like you and I are doing right now.
Right. So as I'm listening to this podcast, I am just full of anticipation, trying to figure out what they're going to dig up. Is it going to be Tara? Is it, you know, and nothing else? Is it another person? Because like I said before, I can't figure out why you would bury something underneath your house. It just baffles me. Turns out it was not Tara. It was, I think they actually did find bones, but it was believed to be animal remains. So they've buried a dog underneath their house. Jamie, it's weird, right? Like, why would you do that?
I don't know. Like, I've buried pets before, but not, like, there are so many reasons not to do that, right?
Right. I mean, you don't want that underneath your house. So when I was listening to that, I was expecting it to be a break in the case. Pretty disappointed that it wasn't, but we'll go on.
Yeah, so there was another possible lead that they ran into. Again, Ocilla is a small town, so over on Snapdragon Road, which is a pretty fun name for a road, there was a house that had burned to the ground. And while they had not found anything, they brought some dogs over anyway, and they actually brought dogs that were to look for corpse or human remains, and the dogs hit on the house. So that led investigators to believe that there may be a body buried in the house. But when they started digging more and started doing more tests, they found that the dogs had really just hit on a sewage pipe that was underneath the house, and it was not a body. However, there was also a black truck that was burned at the home. And as we'll find out later, some other witnesses or people around had mentioned a black truck around Tara's house the night of her disappearance. and also found much later in this process, actually one of the last pieces of evidence that came out during Up and Vanished was somebody that called in and had found a police uniform buried very close to this house on Snapdragon Road. Again, that just sounds odd, but it was an Ocilla Sheriff's Police Department with the name tag ripped off. It looked like it had been thrown in a creek, and they had kind of a flood that had kind of washed it out and cleared back some of the soil, and they discovered this police uniform near this house that was part of the investigation as well. So I guess in a small town, any clue you find is going to seem related.
Right.
But it was just a very odd thing to find.
Well, I mean, you got to think about, why would that be there? Why would a police officer discard their uniform in such a manner? I mean, it's not the right way to do it. You toss it in the trash, maybe take it back to the office and discard it, but you don't take it out and bury it somewhere unless you're trying to cover up something.
Yeah, or I mean, if you're pretending to be a police officer, or you're a police officer that gets evidence on your clothes and has to get rid of them, I mean, I might burn that or bury it under my house, apparently. That's a thing to do.
Right. So as I'm listening to this, I mean, just as a side note, I mean, I couldn't sleep at night knowing that I've buried this and there's a potential for it to be out there and discovered someday. So absolutely, I mean, I'm not trying to give you ways to commit crimes, but I'm going to take that and burn it, if nothing else. So just really weird, and not sure why that is discovered or why they buried it in the first place. Talk a little bit more about the truck, because it was reported that this black truck was in the neighborhood, maybe even talked to some people. I mean, do you remember any of the details about that?
Yeah, there were neighbors that said that a black truck had been circling the neighborhood. Others had even said that it was parked at Tara's house for a little bit in the night of or morning after the murder, and for a long time trying to figure out who this black truck belonged to. Some had even seen it driving away from the house quickly. What else do you remember about the truck?
I feel like I remember a neighbor saying that the truck stopped and talked to him, and that there was kind of a unpleasant interaction. It wasn't a "hey, how you doing," but it was "you need to get out of here" kind of thing. The reported what the men said from the truck. So when I heard that this truck and this house had burned down, and that this truck was found behind it, it looked really suspicious. And then the fact that you have dogs hitting on this house as a potential corpse or remains had been located, it just made me think that this was at least, you know, evidence of a crime that was trying to be destroyed. I will point out, they brought these dogs in and they searched countywide. I mean, several hundreds of acres, and the dogs didn't respond to anything except at this house.
Yeah, I think it hit home for me a little bit. There's actually a local case about a missing young lady named Brooke Farthing where she disappeared from a house that was found burned down the day after she disappeared. So to me, I guess I related the two, and we may cover that case eventually. But any time that a house burns down, you think someone's trying to destroy some kind of evidence. And again, the dogs hitting, the black truck, like it seemed like the perfect storm of things coming together. But ultimately, that was another lead that didn't seem to pan out.
Right. So talk about this suicide note that happened. Well, there was a suicide in Tennessee, and there was a note that went along with that. Do you care to talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, there was a guy named Phineas Gage who killed himself, and he was from Ocilla, and he left a note saying that he just couldn't live with himself anymore, knowing what he knew. And he may have known what happened to Tara. A lot of people believe that that may have been what happened. An odd thing about the note, it didn't give any explanation of what he knew, but it listed six names of people that were followed up with and investigated, and I don't want to bury where we're going to go later. Some of the names are interesting now, but at the time, didn't seem to make any sense. What do you make of it?
You know, I'm still a little baffled by this whole thing. I think part of the note said that he couldn't live with himself for knowing what happened in this case. But you would think, and again, I'm going to try to put myself in this guy's shoes, if he's lived with some kind of remorse for so long to the point where he's going to take his own life, why not put in full detail in this letter what happened so that at least you could feel like there's some justice, or that, you know, you're justifying this? I don't understand why he just didn't spill his guts and tell more about it. So given that he didn't, I questioned, did he really know all this, or was he just a sick man and made this as kind of an scapegoat? I don't really know.
And knowing what I know now, I feel like it may have just been something unrelated. Maybe he knew some other things completely unrelated to Tara Grinstead that he couldn't live with. Maybe it had something to do with his family. Maybe it had something to do with the whole group of names listed there that we're never going to know what it is. Again, he was from Osceola, so it was related back to Tara. So that was a very interesting lead that may or may not still be a part of what's happening, and we'll get to that in a little bit.
So we covered, you know, all of these potential leads. We covered all this evidence rather quickly. But if you listened to Up and Vanish like we did, this is all taking place in real time. So it took weeks to get through all this. So I'm interested, Jamie, just to hear, as we're going through this with Payne Lindsay, did you have any gut feelings? What was your theories early on in this case? Talk us through what you thought.
Yeah, I was always interested in the early suspects, and I always feel like it's somebody that knows the person or has been intimate with the person or is just really close to them. That's almost always the case, unless you're dealing with a serial killer, especially when her car's at her house. Everybody assumed that she made it home after that barbecue. And if she made it home, it's very unlikely that a random person is going to be driving through Osceola and stop at her house. So the names of the early suspects, really, I felt like that's where the answer was. And I, like I said earlier, I felt like Heath Dykes was the most intriguing. I don't remember why he was ruled out. I don't know if this is an alibi with his wife, or if this any of this ever came back to her. But that's where my mind immediately went. And then as we started going through with Payne Lindsay and getting these other details, I started wondering if she was involved in some things that we may not have been aware of that may have gotten her into different trouble.
Right. So for me early on, like you said, this wasn't just a home invasion gone wrong. There was no signs of forcible entry onto the house. Everything in the house is well kept. So kind of made me think that perhaps somebody came to her house. She let them in because she knew them, because no windows are broken, no doors are forced open. Seems like if somebody came into that house and had a struggle, as evidenced by the necklace on the floor, they were let in because it was somebody she knew and trusted. So, you know, it kind of ruled out in my mind the possibility, like you said, of a random, you know, burglar, what have you. So these names were particularly interesting. You know, I mean, I hate to throw guys under the bus, but I thought that Marcus's story just didn't fit in my book. His alibi was that he was with a sheriff that night doing a ride-along. They have some evidence that there was a call made and that they responded to this call together, and it's noted and documented that he's there. When Payne Lindsay follows up on this, the particular call that they were going out to, the guy didn't make contact with police. So there's, you know, a lot of speculation involved there. I go back to the fact that he was on deployment, came back, and didn't tell her he was coming back. Now, that leads me to think that he's pissed off at this girl for some reason. Why would you not, unless you're going to do like a surprise, you know, meeting with her, why not tell her that you're coming back? So, I don't know. His story didn't fit. I didn't like it. So early on in the case, I kind of pegged him, and I mean, you even said it yourself that we now know, and I hope it's okay for me to go here, that we know that it's very likely these three guys had nothing to do with this case. So it sucks that for over 10 years, these guys had to live in that town, or at least close to the town, and see people in the community every day, that when you looked at them walking down the street, they thought you were a killer. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really damaged their lives in a lot of ways, which is just adds to the unfortunate events. Obviously, the loss of life is the biggest thing here. And then the impact that it had on Tara's family and loved ones, but it also impacted these suspects as well. as they were labeled as a killer or as a person of interest in a crime by their community, by the place that they lived. So that's kind of where we were. Up and Vanish started in the fall of 2016. We actually just passed the 12th anniversary, if we can call it that, of her disappearance. It was in October, on the 22nd. But then we get to February of 2017. Ryan Duke, a name that we had never heard before, was arrested for the murder of Tara Grinstead. He had been taken into custody. He has been charged with breaking into her home with intent to burgle and with murdering her using his hand. I said hand, not hands. For whatever reason, that's the way the indictment has been read. And then with removing her body and tampering with evidence. His only prior was a DUI that he had in 2010. He has not been arrested for or accused of any violent crimes that are of record. But he was arrested for her murder on February 24th, just over 11 years after the murder, and it seemed to, or after the disappearance, and it seemed to come out of nowhere. But where did it come from?
That's a great question, and I want to come back to the one prior. So remind me if I don't come back to it. I want to talk
we'll
about
there.
That
yeah,
for sure.
It's important.
But where this comes from is a guy named Bo Dukes. So Jamie, tell us about how Bo Dukes is incorporated in this story.
Bo Dukes and Ryan Duke are from Osceola. They were best friends, and they, at this point, their names are kind of together. Duke and Dukes are two different names. They are not related, to my knowledge. Bo Duke, his grandfather was a politician. He was a representative in the state of Florida, so they were well-known, well-connected, and had a lot of pull. His family also owns... Here we go. A pecan orchard. I have never been so confused on how to say a word in my life until after I listened to this.
Pecan, pecan, regardless.
I feel like there are four ways to say it, and it said every way in Georgia. Pecan, 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 pecan. Am right. I missing any?
I don't know. I don't know that it's that relevant, so we'll just move on.
It bothers me. So his family owns a pecan orchard. You want me to go into his backstory a little more?
Do it, man.
Yeah, so he, again, lived in Osceola, was from a very prominent family. He got into the military, and while he was serving in the Army, he was convicted of theft. And not, like, taking supplies or something like that. But while he was deployed, he was a part of a bigger theft scheme where he was charged for a felony. He did some time, and then he was ordered to pay restitution around $80,000. And while his family may have had that kind of money, they didn't necessarily give it to them. He was still paying that off at the time of when, earlier this year, when all this kind of broke. And then he's the one that magically started talking when a reward was announced for more information on Tara Grinstead.
Right. So how does Bo Dukes relate to Ryan Duke? How does Ryan Duke get arrested for this case? And how does that work with Bo?
So Bo Duke was dating a lady named Brooke. And according to her story, she found out from him in January that he was a part of... the Tara Grinstead case, and that he had helped to dispose of the body when his friend Ryan Dukes had killed her. Brooke, you could theorize that she was trying to help him pay off this debt so she would get the reward money and help him to pay it off. But Brooke went to the GBI, which is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and they're the ones that have been investigating this case since 2005. Coincidentally, this is the largest case file in GBI history, with so many people to interview and so much evidence and lack of evidence and all that. So it's the most well-documented case there. Anyway, she went to the GBI and said, I know that Bo Duke had a role in this, and he helped Bo Duke's, or Ryan Duke, dispose of the body after he killed Tara. And then she encouraged Bo to contact the GBI, and then he started talking to them in hopes of getting a plea deal to get out of the charges that he would ultimately face for helping to dispose of the body, but also to support Brooke in getting the reward for the information. Does that all sound right?
Yeah, that's right. So you would think in your head, right, that Bo confided in this lady and that immediately she would call and report this, because this is some pretty sick stuff that he confides to her. He goes into major detail about what Ryan did, what he did. He talked about taking her body to the pecan orchard that his family owned, disposing it in a manner that is just gross, and I don't know that we should go into all the details of that. But this guy, if he helped Ryan or not, he did some pretty sick stuff. He confided that to Brooke, and Brooke kind of sat on that information for an uncomfortable amount of time. It was weeks before she went and turned all this in. Now, I've done it a few times tonight, so I'll do it again and put myself in her shoes, pretend I'm married to somebody who does this gross act. You know, I don't know what amount of time it would take for me to turn this in, but it's going to be a lot faster than what she did. I mean, your husband is involved in the murder of a person, and I feel like, I don't know, we can get into our theories now if you want to. You've already kind of hit on it a little bit. Just seems like an odd coincidence that she brings this to the GBI and, you know, they're paying restitution for this crime that they've committed and he had been in prison for. It makes me just wonder if the only reason that she brought this up was to claim a reward.
Sure. And I don't know at this point if that reward has been paid out. I think they're still investigating to see what Bo's role was and if Brooke had a role. But he did. He went and told the GBI that Ryan came to him and told him that he had killed Tara and asked him to help dispose of the body, and that they went and disposed of her in his family's pecan orchard by burning her. Again, the details, the actual details are horrible, but essentially they burned her body in a huge bonfire type thing. And then over the course of time, allegedly, he has told people that he was involved in that way. Of course, most people, I think, thought he was full of crap, so they did not agree with him there, or they didn't believe him. But nobody else really came forward that we knew of at the time of the arrest.
Right. So Bo has been arrested for his part in this case. He has since made bond and has been released. Ryan Duke, still in jail, and we're just awaiting trial now. I will say it will be a long time before we ever get to a trial in this case. And the unfortunate thing is that the only witness to this crime is Bo Dukes. And you want to talk a little bit about his most recent charges?
Yeah, so in the last week, he has been charged with lying to the GBI, so essentially with perjury or misleading the police in this case. Actually, two charges in two separate counties in Georgia. And it's been pertaining directly to the Tara Grinstead case. And why this may be very important is that the original charges placed on Bo, as far as disposing of a body or tampering with evidence, may be compromised. Those charges may be compromised because we recently found out that the police went to the pecan orchard in 2005 on a tip that the body had been disposed of there by Ryan Dukes.
Right. So you can get my details on this are a little iffy, so please chime in and correct me if I'm wrong. But so back in 2005, they get a tip that they should check out the pecan orchard, and it's called into this particular guy. I think at the last minute they kind of switch it up and they say, no, don't go there. You know, kind of almost seems like a cover-up situation, right, Jamie?
Yeah, so there were two different police precincts that were involved that were supposed to go and check it out. And the local Osceola guy as he approached. Essentially, the pecan orchard was a different county than Osceola was, so they both had to investigate because it was a Terra case, but it was in Swain County. And when the officer from Osceola arrived in the county where the pecan orchard was, they called him off and said, "Nah, just go back home." Now, what we don't know is if they investigated and said, "We didn't find anything, you should just go back home," or, "We can't let this guy see what we found because Bo Duke's family is so important, we need to send this guy home." We don't know why. What we do know is that the orchard was investigated. Now, that's important because due to statute of limitations laws, once the police have determined that an act took place and that a person may or may not have been involved, then that's when the window of a statute of limitations opens up. Now, if Bo is implied with and accused of and charged with murder, there is no statute of limitation on murder. If you're talking about sexual assault, usually that statute of limitation is 15 years. If you're talking about anything else, you're looking at 4 to 7 years of, if you know somebody was involved with something, you have to charge them with it within 4 to 7 years, or you can never charge them. So if they start investigating this orchard knowing that Bo Duke was involved, and that was 12 years ago, then those original charges they had against him may just go away.
Right. Kind of frustrating to me that they had a lead that took them to the orchard where her body was, and it's very likely, or at least possible, that Bo Dukes was involved and that he walks away from this with no charges because of a statute of limitations. Now, I will say this, you know, this is an ongoing, very active case. There's a gag order in place by the court system that prevents anybody within this case to be talking to media, specifically because of the Up and Vanish podcast. I mean, it has generated such a huge following, and Payne Lindsay has done such a great job covering this. They've put a gag order in place so that he can't get his hands on any more details. So we don't know if there's going to be any more charges or any new charges brought up against Bo in this case. But from what we have so far, because of the gag order, it leaves room for question that, you know, this guy could walk away from this and not be punished.
And that's why the two new charges are so important, because even if the old ones go away, these perjury charges could still stick because they pertain to things that have happened in the last few months. There are reasons not to believe Bo. There are so many reasons not to believe Bo. Do you want to talk about the conversation that was discovered that he had on Twitter?
Yeah, so earlier you said that this guy started talking. Well, he never stopped talking. I mean, this guy is, I want to use the word narcissistic. I mean, it seems like he wants to get credit for this in a way, as sick and twisted as they may sound. But he has been talking to numerous people. But one of the conversations is actually documented in depth, verbatim, on Up and Vanished. I would highly encourage you to go check out that conversation. It's a case evidence episode, so it's towards the end of the series. I would check it out. But basically, we have Bo Dukes talking to a lady about exactly what happened, and he just kind of lays it all out on the table. He talks about taking her body to the orchard. He talks about some gruesome stuff, and again, I don't want to go into all that, but he talks about burning her body. He talks about watching it happen. And this isn't just a process that takes place one night. This is something that takes place over a series of days. So day in and day out, he's at the orchard. He pretty much stays there for a few days and just restarts fires on this to try to destroy evidence. He goes into much more gruesome detail than I want to go into tonight. But at the end of that conversation, what I walked away with was that we are dealing with a very, very sick man. And a man who, in my opinion, I'm thinking more that he's the one who's committed this act without Ryan's involvement. I want to go back, if it's okay, to the prior arrests for both of these guys. I've been a social worker for 10 years. I deal with some of the scum of the earth day in and day out. It's very rare, in my mind, that you have a suspect charged with murder who doesn't have any priors other than a DUI, and that DUI took place in 2010. So I have a really hard time believing Ryan Duke broke into this lady's house, murdered her, took her body somewhere and disposed of it, and then for over 10 years he's laid low off the radar and has no other charges. In my mind, that doesn't fit. I mean, if you're going to go as far as doing all that, you're going to have history before, and you're certainly going to have history after in the system.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons not to trust Bo, and one's that he's so manipulative. And the fact that that charge is a DUI, are there other reasons for us to believe that Ryan could be manipulated in this case?
That's a good question, Jamie. So towards the end of Up and Vanished, Payne Lindsay gets a tip, a phone call, and it is so interesting. I mean, it just perfectly fits with what I already thought about the case. So here's the story. I don't remember the guy's name, but this guy is called into Payne Lindsay, and he said that around the time of all this happening, his brother is up at a bar partying hard and walks out to his car and notices a guy trying to check a battery. Something's going on with his car. The hood's open. He's working on it. So this brother of this guy goes up to the guy working on the car, notices that he is just super impaired. Obviously, this guy is not in any shape to drive home that night. So the brother gets out, starts tinkering with the car, and tells the guy, you know what, can't fix it tonight, but why don't you just hop in with me? I'll take you wherever you're going. So starts talking to this guy, drops him off. Turns out that it's Ryan Dukes. So Ryan is in the car talking to this guy, and he says something interesting that I'll never forget. He tells the guy that he gets drunk sometimes and he blacks out. And he said that one time he blacked out and they told me that I killed somebody. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the picture that comes to mind at that point, it's like the reveal at the end of a movie where you start having all these flashbacks of maybe Bo Duke killed Tara himself and then convinced Ryan that he did it while he was drunk. That's like all those flashbacks started happening in my mind, like watching a movie. And if somebody is blackout drunk and they don't ever know what happens, I would think it would be easy to convince them that something happened and then pull them into it. And then, of course, they would never be the wiser. And Bo really seems like the kind of guy that would do that. Of course, we don't have that definitive conclusion, but I think that's an easy place to go.
So there's been some other things about Bo that have come out that really fits with this story of the possibility of him doing this on his own. You have to take these for what they're worth. I mean, people, this is a hugely followed podcast. People may be trying to get attention or make something up about this guy. So I don't know, but I think it's worth saying that there have been women who have come forward saying that Bo has sexually assaulted them. Now, here's the creepiest part of this is one allegation reports that Bo took a couple to the pecan orchard, tied a girl to a tree, and sexually assaulted her. Now, to me, this seems like a criminal who is recreating something that has happened in the past. It's super disturbing. We can't validate this. He's not been charged with this, so purely speculation. But if it's true, it's highly disturbing, and it, you know, leads me again to think that Bo is solely responsible for this and that he has pegged all this on Ryan in a way that, you know, you said he's a manipulator. This is him manipulating Ryan.
Yeah, I feel like where there's smoke, there's fire, and there have been enough of these allegations throughout the last several months that I believe that he is capable of such an act, of being more involved in Tara's death than we know. And I just really hope that the actual truth comes out. I mean, we started out with no information, a few names of suspects. Now we're to the point where we know that Bo was involved, and we think that Ryan was involved as well. But it almost raises more questions than it gives answers at that point. So I really hope we get to the bottom of it. But I definitely think that that he's the kind of guy that could go to that place.
Yeah. You said it best, man. I have more questions than I have answers at this point. But at the end of the day, the only thing I want is to know what happened. I think Tara's family deserves that. Tara's loved ones deserve that. This community deserves that. I mean, it's been over 10 years of wondering why this would happen and who's responsible. So I hope that if Bo Dukes or Ryan is responsible, I hope that the definitive truth comes out of this case.
Yeah, I agree. That's all we hope for this case or for others that we've covered. But I think the twists and turns of this one have definitely make it an interesting case to follow and to look at, and gives me kind of a different perspective as I look at missing persons or even unsolved murder cases, because like I said, I always look at people that are intimately involved. And while these guys weren't directly involved, they were former students of hers. And maybe she did have a relationship with them or was socializing with them in ways that we didn't know and that we don't know. Hopefully we will at some point. But gives me a different perspective as I look at these cases.
I certainly want you to come back and check us out each week, but if you would like to know more about this story, highly encourage you to check out Up and Vanished. There are, you know, this guy took a whole season worth of material and investigated this case in such a way that was just truly amazing. I think without Payne Lindsay's involvement, we would not be sitting here today talking about this case. So I would encourage you to go check out that podcast. Of course, come back to True Crime Cast, where we will have another case next week.
Yeah, we're not going to be living commercial for different podcasts every week. It just so happened that Payne Lindsay's work became part of the case. After the first few episodes, he became a part of the story. So if we didn't mention his work and the work of his team, Philip Holloway and Maurice Godwin, then we would be remiss in that. So we're here to cover the cases, and he's a big part of this case. But don't expect us to be giving commercials for other podcasts every week.
Not a sponsor, but you could be. So yeah.
Subscribe, review, tell your friends.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We'd love to have you reach out to us. Shoot us an email, truecrimecast@gmail.com. If you have any cases that you would like for Jamie and I to research, we would certainly like to take a look at that. So email those to us. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. But most importantly, come back next week.
Thanks. You guys have a good week.